Pakistani parliament and cabinet are dissolved hours after a no-confidence motion against Prime Minister Imran Khan is blocked. A two-month truce now in effect in Yemen. The Ansar movement says it's committed to the ceasefire as long as the other party adheres to it. And Ukraine's top negotiator says that Russia has verbally agreed to key Ukrainian proposals for ending the conflict. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning with the latest about the political drama unfolding in Pakistan, almost an hour ago, the parliament rejected a no-confidence motion tabled by the opposition to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan. Deputy Parliament Speaker blocked that motion, calling it unconstitutional. President Arif Alvi has dissolved the National Assembly upon a request by the Prime Minister. Imran Khan's cabinet has also been dissolved in anticipation of fresh elections. Now, reacting to this, the joint opposition says that they'll petition the Supreme Court to rule against the blocking the no-confidence move. The opposition blames Khan for failing to revive the economy and crack down on corruption. But the Prime Minister says that the United States has been orchestrating efforts to topple him. Now, Yemen says it's committed to a UN-brokered ceasefire with the Saud-led coalition, as long as the other side adheres to it. Army spokesman made the announcement in a tweet. According to the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen, the two-month truce began at 1600 GMT. All offensive military operations, including ground, aerial, and navy attacks by the two sides, will be stopped under the ceasefire deal.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tensions running high in the occupied West Bank and Israel's violent raids and deadly shootings in Palestinian villages and towns. Palestinians, mostly youth, hit the streets chanting anti-Israel slogans. 10 Palestinians were killed and dozens arrested in Israeli crackdowns that began earlier this week. The PA has strongly condemned the killings and stressed its call to the international community to provide protection for the Palestinians. Resistance groups, the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, have issued strong warnings to Tel Aviv after its forces opened fire on a vehicle, leaving 3 Palestinians dead in the early hours of Saturday. Hamas described the killings as a cowardly assassination and said that the regime cannot guarantee its security by killing Palestinians. Islamic Jihad identified the victims as its members and said that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished. Author and journalist Robert Fantina believes that the Palestinian Authority's security coordination with Israel gives the regime a free hand to commit crimes against Palestinians.
First of all, with the sacred month of Ramadan, more and more people want to be able to worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and of course, Israel does not want this to happen. So they are, anything that is indicating more people going into Jerusalem, going to that area, is going to cause Israel to claim they have security issues, and they have to perform these mass arrests and these extrajudicial killings, which are completely unjust and completely in violation of international law. Additionally, the PA has said that, has condemned these killings, but that's hypocritical because Mahmoud Abbas is complicit in Israeli crimes against Palestinians with his so-called security coordination that his organization, the PA, has done with Israel for many years. If that security coordination were to cease, then the occupation would be much more difficult for the Israelis to maintain. But at this time, during this sacred month, these killings, these arrests, these night raids are even more appalling than they are under other circumstances.
People in Gaza Strip are observing yet another month of Ramadan under tough conditions due to the inhumane Israeli siege. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has the story.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Let's now take a look at the conflict in Ukraine. Air strikes have rocked the strategic port city of Odessa. Ukrainian air defense batteries are said to have intercepted some of the missiles that were fired at the city. The blast sent up columns of black smoke with flames visible, apparently, in an industrial area. Russian forces appear to be withdrawing from Ukraine's north, but Kiev's warning that Moscow is consolidating and preparing powerful strikes in the south. And that echoes a chorus of Western assessments that Russian troops are regrouping. Odessa, a historical city of around 1 million people, is Ukraine's largest Black Sea port. Now, meantime, on the diplomatic front, Ukraine's top negotiator says that Moscow has agreed to key Ukrainian proposals, raising hopes that the talks are moving forward. David Arakamia says that the Russian side has agreed verbally, but did not give details on the terms of the proposals. He said, however, that Moscow agreed in talks that a referendum on the neutral status of Ukraine will be the only way out of the situation. No immediate comments from Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Saturday that talks with a hostile Ukraine aren't easy, but favored the continuation of the process. The two sides have held several rounds of negotiations, and the next round is yet to be announced. The Ukrainian negotiator has indicated that any future meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents will take place in Turkey. Russia's military operation in Ukraine and the West's response by imposing a flurry of sanctions against Moscow have renewed the debate whether such punitive measures result in the desired outcome. Voices from Washington's very political establishment are warning about the dire consequences of waging an economic war against Russia. They're also questioning the legality of the U.S. involvement in this conflict.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massie, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with a country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions.
Russian gas accounted for 40% of the European Union's total gas imports and 45% of its gas consumption in 2021. Even before the Russian operation in Ukraine, the bloc had been experiencing a rise in gas prices. Imposing sanctions while having no real substitute at this point does not seem like the most sensible choice for Europe. It appears that anti-Russia sanctions are set to backfire on the West, especially when it comes to ordinary people.
As the U.S. takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massie agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massey says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know. And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books, a former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania. From his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for $1 a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I step into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment, to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to, I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks, while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program in the hands of the CIA doctors. She was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971, and I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd heard about, we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. There's a, I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we, if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology.
Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. Don't forget to share your views and comments by simply emailing or just following us on Facebook or Twitter. It's goodbye.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen that we've been given this opportunity to gather once more and take little reminders to help and aid us through the day when we feel like we need a little pick-me-up or a little supplement to, in order to better navigate and be better people. Life is hard. There's no doubt about it. There's no questioning the fact that life is legit hard. And often people make it harder. No one can deny it. It's an experience that we go through since the very moment that we're born. There's always a struggle. There's always a fight. There's always something that we are grappling with, wrestling with, trying to overcome, trying to move past. And it's part of the journey, basically. And it's inevitable, and we just have to accept it. But it becomes intolerably hard when we feel that this pain and these difficulties and hardships that we go through in life are in vain and have no meaning. I think a writer or philosopher once said this, I don't remember who, pardon my faulty memory, that any hardship is bearable as long as it has meaning. And the older I get, the more true that feels. Let's listen to a short anecdote about life's hardship, and we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to another episode of Lantern with a nice story. Growing deep and strong is the title of today's story. I invite you to listen to it. One day my mother and I were working together in the garden where we were transplanting plants for the third time. Growing from seed in a small container, the plants had been transferred to a larger container, then transplanted into the garden. Now, because I was moving, we were transplanting them once again, inexperienced as a gardener. I turned to my green-thumbed mother. Isn't this bad for them? I asked, as we dug them up and shook the dirt from the roots. Won't it hurt these plants being uprooted and transplanted so many times? Oh, my mother replied, transplanting doesn't hurt them. In fact, it's good for the ones that survive. That's how their roots grow strong. Their roots will grow deep and they will make strong plants. Often I felt like those small plants uprooted and turned upside. Sometimes I've endured the change willingly, sometimes reluctantly, but usually my reaction has been a combination. Won't this be hard on me? I ask. Wouldn't things be better if things remained the same? That's when I remember my mother's words. That's how the roots grow deep and strong.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at a story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Another aspect that I feel difficulties and hardships helped me strengthen my roots in was humility. And it gave me a sense of humbleness. It gave me a sense of, well, anything can happen to anyone at any point. Then what's the point of being arrogant and proud and feeling yourself high and mighty and above other people when all of this could be taken away in a blink of an eye and there's nothing you can do about it? And once I developed that sort of humility in myself and got a real, you know, strong dose of reality, I think I became more compassionate toward others. I think I became less fussy about life circumstances. I think I freaked out less when, you know, ups and downs of life occurred. I became more confident. I became more calm because I knew that, you know, this is all life is about. It's not a big deal. When I was younger, if I was faced with obstacles and, you know, mountain peaks and valleys, it legit freaked me out. And I thought to myself, oh, well, why does this have to happen to me? How am I going to handle this? This is so inconvenient. This is so uncomfortable. This is so difficult, yada, yada, yada. But now life's knocked me down so many times that I know better than to complain about these inevitable phenomena. And I've realized that, you know, I'm nothing special. This happens to everyone. Worse things have happened to better people. It's all a part of life. It's a learning journey. It depends on how I look at it. I can either bellyache and complain and nag and rant my way through this, or I can accept it, come to terms with it, rely on Allah for help and guidance and strength, and weather the storm. Either way, I have to put myself through this. And that definitely strengthened my roots as a person, individually, and as how I treat other people. I most definitely freak out less regarding the hardships of my loved ones as well. There was perhaps a point in my life if someone I loved, a friend or family or someone I even knew, was going through some hard times, I would feel physically restless because I didn't want them to be suffering. I didn't want them to struggle. I didn't want them to be sad. But now I feel like, eh. I mean, I'm sorry that you're going through that. I really am. If there was anything I could do to stop it, I still would. But at the end of the day, you live, you learn. And all of this is strength. All of this is strength. And all of this builds me. And when our roots are strong, we can see its effect in every aspect of our being. It is the tree with the strong roots that can have branches that reach out to the sky. Strong, sturdy trunk that people can lean on, depend on. Foliage and leaves that people can sit beneath its shades, and beautiful blossoms and fresh, colorful fruits. It'll all be worth it. Don't worry. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That's all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.